the latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
DRF Sports Forum Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Forum delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsforum. Enter code DRF Sports.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Do you ever wonder what happens to your old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years? We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and Kent DeSarmo and Afternoon Delights absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9 938-4643.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back at the races, a little less than 20 to the top of the hour, and as always, the post-Royal Ascot recap with Nick Luck himself, and undoubtedly after an intense 5 days decompressing. Nick, congratulations to you and the entire team. It was wildly entertaining. Well done.
Oh, Steve, you're very kind, and it's such a pleasure to be able to play a small part in bringing the event to homes in North America, and it's just my good fortune, really, that NBC have chosen to make this a sort of heritage event for the network. So, yeah, really, really delighted with how it's been received, and as I say, just very privileged to be a small part of that.
Well, and I will reiterate what I said to Johnny and something I wrote on Saturday afternoon, the fact that, you know, you had to be ready for this and knowing, you know, how intense the preparations have to be, doing what you did in the wake of a serious health incident, to me was even, you know, an added enhancement of your already ridiculously pristine reputation. I don't know how many people would have been able to deliver the way you did.
Well, so you're kind as always, and you flatter me greatly. But I think, if anything, it just gave me something to look forward to, and there was every incentive to get back. And I'm very lucky. I've had a, you know, I don't want to go into too much detail and bore everyone with it again, but I had a pretty lucky escape, and I'm back feeling pretty good. So I was just happy to get going again, and there's no better event to get going with than Ascot. So so no, it's great. Please excuse the rather loud sawing noise. There's some gents doing some work south of my house.
Nice.
There may be a little interference on the line, so apologies for that.
Not at all. Let's hit some of the highlights. And this really did have a little bit of everything. You hinted a week ago Friday that weather might come into play. And luckily, it really only affected things the first 2 days of the stand. And then it got glorious for the next 3 days.
Yeah, it got better as the week went on. There's no doubt about that. Wednesday was pretty grim in places. And I think, you know, from a U.S. point of view, I certainly feel that Wesley Ward would consider himself unfortunate not to have had a winner. I think Kimari probably would have won if the rain hadn't come. So that was probably one missed opportunity from an international point of view. But apart from that, I don't think the weather did too much damage. And Ascot's very fortunate that since its redevelopment, the track drained so far. Which, you know, if you were watching, you'll have heard us say that plenty last week, particularly the straight track drained so far that you had, you know, genuine soft ground come the back end of Wednesday, and it was, you know, genuine good to firm, and 1 2-year-old lowered a 2-year-old track record Saturday. So to that end, they're very lucky, really, and you know, all's well that ended well.
Now, the one thing when it came to particularly to Wesley Ward and to American interests, Maven not being able to run, that was the one, that was a little bit of a, that was unfortunate, simply put.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think if it had been a day later, he would have done. You know, this hadn't dried out quite enough, and like, he was probably chastened a little bit by the experience of the previous day. So you can understand that. I was looking forward to seeing him run. I'd seen him work the previous week and thought he looked the business, really. And, yeah, I must say, I was hoping he'd run. And Wesley said on the show last week that he would stick around and head to the Prix de Bois at Deauville. So could easily have a European campaign. And I think it's looking increasingly important to those responsible for American Pharaoh that his progeny do just as well in Europe, if not better, than they're doing in America. So I think there's very much a dual-pronged attack on the U.S. and Europe with his progeny.
Well, the horses that we were taken with early the first couple of days, Arizona's performance, Ryan Moore and Aidan O'Brien getting on the board early on, and how about Blue Point establishing what would end up being the story of the week, Circus Maximus with that upset for Aidan, that Flaxman/Coolmore partnership. The Grand Vizor, that was a wonderful moment for in the handicap race on Tuesday for Ian Williams. That was really touching.
Yeah, a lot of good stories there on the Tuesday. Just sort of taking them in that order. Arizona looked a smart horse. He looked as though he needed every yard of the 6 furlongs. Sort of horse who ought to make up into an early classic contender next year. For all that maybe it didn't look as strong a Coventry as perhaps we thought beforehand, it was certainly formful with the three favourites filling out the first, second and third, and the rain had come and it looked a little bit like hard work. I thought the training performance of Circus Maximus was absolutely masterful. I don't think anybody in their right mind thought that cutting that horse back to a mile was the way forward, but Aidan somehow saw something, cut him back to a mile, put blinkers on him, and chose to fork out a £45,000 supplementary fee to get him in the race. Let's face it, he's got plenty of horses he could have chucked in anyway. So we should have taken the tip. We didn't. And the rest is history. And you mentioned the Grand Vizier. That's a good story as well, because here's a horse that the bloodstock agent Alex Elliott took a chance on with some friends of his. The horse had some breathing issues, quite well documented. They were all aware of that, but they still shelled out fair money for the horse and took a chance. They tried to campaign him as a hurdler. He refused at the first hurdler entry on his debut, and then second time he checked out after a circuit because his wind wasn't very good. And the vets all said, well, the horse just can't breathe. But back on the flat with no obstacles and with a patient ride, he got into his rhythm, and his pipes and tubing were obviously all working okay. And he won, and he won off a big weight as well. So he could end up giving them a lot of fun. He could land up being a borderline Melbourne Cup horse or something like that. So there was plenty to enjoy on that Thursday.
We should also include Blue Point establishing, you know, the first half of you know, what is one of those achievements that is fairly unique, not to international racing, but really anywhere. You come back at the highest level, and not to, you know, jump forward, you know, to Saturday, but Blue Point, talk about burnishing your reputation as the world's best sprinter.
Yeah, clever. It was a clever piece of training, clever piece of placing. The horse has got such an affinity for Ascot. He's always loved it there. Never run a bad race. Won a stack of races there. He loves the surface. And Charlie Appleby said when the horse was declared on Thursday for the Diamond Jubilee, Charlie Appleby said to a few of us, well, that surprised you all, didn't it? The answer was yes, it had surprised us. We all had our eye off the ball. But when you looked at it, in the cold light of day, well, it was obvious. It was the obvious thing to do, run him in both races. And the backup that hadn't been done by a lot of people for an awful long time, after Choisir did it in 2003, it became the norm for a little bit, especially for horses coming over from Australia who were regular fixtures in those sprints at the time. It became a popular thing to do. And since the sort of end of the Aussie sprint era at Ascot, the last few years, the horses haven't really tried to do the double, and the fives and the sixes have been rather separate. But for him, who's really a 5.5 furlong horse, if he wanted to try and mark his ideal distance, it was sort of the obvious thing to do. And he now sails into retirement. I don't know whether that means that he'll be down to Australia in time to shuttle to Southern Hemisphere stallion duty, or whether they'll just keep him wrapped up until he starts doing what he has to do at Dalham Hall next spring. But that's it. He's done on the race course, but it was a great way to bow out.
Without a doubt. Moving to day two and Crystal Ocean. Clearly the big story. You go to the Prince of Wales, and one of the highlights, even though it wasn't a big field, it didn't need to be. You had some real serious campaigners, and here was Sir Michael and Evelyn de Rothschild, and that was quite a funny post race interview with Larry Fitzgerald showing up. I got the biggest kick out of that.
Who knew?
I wrote that to someone.
and Lady de Rothschild, Lynn Forrester de Rothschild, American and wife of Sir Evelyn, were good friends. But they clearly were. It was a little opaque as to how their friendship had begun, but he was there as a mascot, and a very lucky mascot he was too. So I have to go to every race meet with Crystal Ocean now. But it was lovely to see the joy that they shared in the victory. And Lady de Rothschild was so thrilled for her husband, but particularly her late sister-in-law, Renee Robeson, who did manage a lot of the breeding interests at South Court started. And I think it was a poignant success for them. And Larry seemed to be loving it. He was loving Royal Ascot. What a gent as well. People who'd interviewed him before said what a nice guy he was, and he really was a real jet. So that was nice. I enjoyed that. That was a special moment from a broadcast perspective. And the horse is a really good horse. He was overdue a victory at the top level on world rankings. As I said on the show last week, he was officially the fourth best horse in the world last year after that performance in the King George. We knew he loved Ascot. I didn't think he liked the ground, but he probably got away with it. A magical, with a solid enough yardstick in second. We knew that Sea of Class didn't really turn up because the ground had gone against her and her trainer was running her, but sometimes you got to take your chance. It wasn't his fault that the rain then came down in biblical proportions for the next hour. But Crystal Ocean's a rock-solid horse, and he'd take all the beating in the King George, and he'd probably land up in the Breeders' Cup turf, I would have thought.
A couple of the connection stories that ended up dotting all 5 days. Danny Tudhope, certainly, and of course Ryan Moore starts to keep pace or tries to keep pace with Dottori. And as the week goes on, I mean, Dottori's performance, put that in perspective for everyone. You know, we see riders, Nick, win, you know, three straight, four straight, six on a day. But at this level, at this particular stand, at Dottori's age, at this stage of his career, it was something to behold.
When you think about how long he's been a star and how long he's been performing at the very highest level, it's quite extraordinary. Yes, there's been a little bit of ebb and flow. And there was a period, as I said yesterday, for a few months in 2012 when he left Godolphin and he got a drug ban and had to sit out 6 months. And when he came back, it looked as though he was not really the force of old for a few weeks, months, and then broke his ankle not long after he got that life-saving job with Alpha Cab Racing. That really kind of put him back on some good horses. But then he broke his ankle and missed the ride on Trev in the Arc. And just seemed that things weren't going for him at all. And you wondered whether he could ever get back to the Dottori of old. And since the hookup with John Godson, which came after William Buick signed for Godolphin, and that freed up a space for Dottori's old ally, Godson, he's just not looked back. And he's looked an even better rider and even more assured and even more skillful and even more full of guile than even he did in his pomp in his late 20s and early 30s. It's quite remarkable. He doesn't look any older. He's amazingly young to look at for a 48-year-old, infuriatingly. And he doesn't seem to be showing any signs of slowing down. And if anything, he sort of added, I know it doesn't seem it when he's doing the flying dismount and kissing everybody, but he's definitely added a more considered side to his game as well. You know, I think back early in his career, he was someone who was either on or off in terms of the ebullience of personality. And now you sit and interview him, yes, he's great fun and he's charismatic, but he's often can be measured and considered and talk about the game in the round. And he's now, I think, arguably an even more important ambassador for the sport than he was when he was even closer to the zeitgeist in the early 90s.
The thing that, to me, stood out, it was one thing to cap it all off with Stradivarius, who was one of the week's, you know, most logical winners in the Gold Cup. But he did it with prices, including that Ali in the opener for Simon Crisford that was a $20 horse over here.
He was. I mean, he was quite well bet in the UK. I think the secret was out about Ali before the race here. I don't think it would have gone down as a huge shot. The ride I thought was an absolute masterclass, and really only somebody like him or Ryan or this side of the Atlantic can pull that off when they're so high and going so well with Star Cluster in the Ribbledale. I couldn't have given her really much shot going into the race. She was well bet because there was money rolling up onto her, and she just never really was going all that well. And it was just one of those where you thought, well, he's not going to win on this one. Oh, well, he might. Oh, he is. It was extraordinary. She never appeared to be really taking the bridle. And yet she's ended up winning quite decisively. And there was something about that win which was pure jockey, I think.
Well, and the celebration, you know, was on. In between Ali and Starcatcher was Sangarius. And then came, you know, the capper, and I mean, it obviously, you know, dominated the headlines and the storylines.
Yeah, Stradivarius is a terrific horse. I thought this was the toughest task by some considerable way. But again, it was a question of the horse having some tactical speed for a stayer, so he wasn't going to get caught out by what essentially was quite a slowly run race that ended up turning into more of a sprint than you might otherwise expected. And again, good positioning on the part of Dottori. He's just never laid too far off the gallop. He loves riding the horse because he says the horse is an easy ride through a race. He can sit in what he wants, and he can ask him to pick up, and he's got much readier acceleration than most horses who excel over that the ground. So, you know, however races pan out tactically, he never seems to get undone, which is why he's been undefeated since October 2017. And there was some perfectly valid points he made before the race about, well, what's he beaten? How much has he actually improved? How much has he needed to do to win all these races in what's not normally a really classy division? But these were definitely the best group of horses he's faced. If you had Kew Gardens in there, then that would have been a proper race. But you had Cross Country, who won the Melbourne Cup. He might have finished second if he'd sat a bit closer. You had DXB, who's hard as nails. And had plenty of other very worthy adversaries in there. And he keeps turning them away.
From a betting standpoint, you know, by that point, of course, people are now piling on, and they're going to bet, you know, they're going to bet him off the board. And by the time we got to the closer, you know, the end of the day, and I get to watch this race, the last race, the sixth each day, a little bit more than, you know, than when I'm on the air live, Nick, and we're taking the calls. But when we got to the King George V, that handicap that closed out the day, how do we over here miss the opportunity to have Aidan O'Brien run 1-2-3 with 22-1, 11-2, and 25-1 shots?
It's just insane. But the point is that he swept these races so often you become blasé about it. I know Chad Brown's now started to do it in surf races in the United States, but the regularity with which Aidan's knocking out the first, second, and third in big races is ridiculous. I mean, it should be pointed out, and it has been pointed out, that he ran 53 horses at Royal Ascot last week. 53! Now, that's more than most people have in their barn, let alone the runners they can have at one boutique five-day fixture. The depth is remarkable, even so, to make it a first, second, and third. And in a race for three-year-olds as well, it's pretty remarkable.
You know, each one of these Ascots, we see a winner that it was tough to come by. And if you've got any hints, and the biggest opportunities, Nick, it does seem to come in those handicap races. And, for instance, a horse like Rafe Beckett and Harry Bentley on Biometric was a 30-1 shot. What should we look for in years to come at Ascot for horses like this? What hints are there?
Well, I think that result was interesting because Turgenev, that Frankie was riding, was clearly taking a huge chunk of the market because of the roll-up factor and bookmakers ducking for cover with possible accumulators rolling up and potential huge payouts. But they had to make Turgenev a very heavy favorite in order to try and offset some of those liabilities. That was taking a huge chunk out of the market. And for the same reason, he was probably taking a big chunk out of the U.S. pools as well. So there were some artificially inflated prices relative to what you might have expected it to be. A huge field as well. The key was Biometric. It was a clever bit of training because he looked like a pretty smart 7 furlong horse his first two runs. But you're not allowed to run in a handicap of that nature, of that prestige, unless you've had three runs. Even if you've won, even if the handicapper has been able to allot you a provisional rating, you can't run in one of those heritage handicaps unless you've had three lifetime starts. So he needed to get another start in. So the only two-score race to run of him was a race shy of his best distance. So he got beat. And everyone thought, well, he's been beaten in a 6 furlong novice race at Lingfield. He's not going to be winning at Royal Ascot. But really, that run was just a function of him needing to get another run in, more than the fact that he wasn't able to show his form. So that's why he was a bigger price than he might have been. But he was unexposed and had pretty powerful connections. So it wasn't completely unfindable.
Well, and these are the things that when we read analysis and we listen to everybody on the broadcast, you know, trying to sniff out, you know, some of these unusual winners and especially when the fields, you know, those handicap events seem to have the bulkiest fields. I don't know if it's gotten back to you about the pool splitting, but you know, there were some pools that ended up not being commingled because of the quantity of entrants, and you know that made for actually a couple of rare opportunities.
Right. No, I haven't really taken stock of that. But obviously, in those big handicaps, there isn't the technological facility, is there, to have that many runners officially listed in the pool in the U.S. I guess.
Yes and no. I mean, there was the ability to bet them, but for I guess the transmission into that commingled, that international, what was it, a 10-country commingled pool. Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the tote providers, I believe it's United, can't do it if it's over 20. And so as a result, you had a local pool that ended up paying $80 on, oh my gosh, who did I write to about this? I did save it, and it's in my phone, but I got all these wedding pictures from the weekend. Two of the pools paid 80, two of the ADWs paid $84, and the rest of the world got 33.
Right, got you. Got you. Interesting. Well,
yeah, it was funny. Raffle prize. It was the race with Kamari.
Yeah. So raffle prize. Frankie Dettori won. Paid 18-1 locally. On obviously there was a big opportunity on your local turf. I think next year that there may be a provision to try and commingle these pools more efficiently or more effectively. Anyway.
And we'll, as we figure this out here days later, we'll explain. Well, I'm going to get somebody early this week to explain exactly the issues. Let's get to Friday and Saturday, and of course the Commonwealth and the coronation on Friday, the Albany, which we always have come to now to look forward to because of the regular involvement we get from Wesley Ward. Some thoughts about this. Roger Varian with that Daya came through.
Yeah, and that was continuing a motif of the season so far. Roger Varian was already a very powerful trainer numerically. He already had a significant level of international repute through his brief training career because he had plenty of horses run good races at Breeders' Cups and in the Far East as well. But this season, he's really broken through to get himself a seat at the top table. He's won Group 1 races at home and abroad. He's had classic contenders. He's now had a brace of Royal Ascot winners, who both of whom look very exciting. And he seems to be eliciting significant sort of progression from his horses, from 2-3 and 3-4 and 4-5 even. So that really, his victories with Daya and with Defoe just confirmed what we've been seeing all season. His horses are in great form. He's got a fantastic premises now. It used to be Clyde Britton's stable on the Bury Road in Newmarket. Fantastic premises for a big, big stable, very powerful numerically. And he's a force to be reckoned with now in coming seasons. And the same could be said, really, about Andrew Balding. Again, numerically very strong, huge injection of support into his stable, his historic stable. The very sadly deceased Leicester City chairman, Vichai, whose son is continuing the King Power Racing involvement in the game. And that's been a massive boost to Balding stable, and they were rewarded with two Royal Ascot winners as well. So a lot of the results over the week and a lot of the people who were successful were perfectly emblematic of the state of play in UK and Irish racing right now.
A couple of other notable performances, and how about Advertise in the Commonwealth? That one more for Frankie yet.
Yeah, I've just said that, and Advertise rather back to Trent, yeah. Because Martin Mead has not been in particularly good form this season, and his horses have taken a while to adjust to their new surroundings because he moved stables from Newmarket to the historic Manton training establishment, where plenty have succeeded, Peter Chappell-Heim and Barry Hill to name but two, but one or two have failed quite spectacularly. So it's not always a great move, but it's an amazing stable, an amazing setup, and if you can make it work for you, it's probably one of the best training establishments in the land. And that will have been a huge, huge boost to Martin Mead, getting that Group 1 Royal Ascot winner. And what a result in that race for Phoenix Thoroughbred, having the first and the second. So that was a notable race for a number of reasons. I'm not sure it was the strongest race. It was a slightly disappointing turnout in terms of field size relative to what it had been in its early years. And Sovereigns, I didn't think, looked wildly enthusiastic about the game. And I thought he was a little bit disappointing. And he hasn't really shown what he could do as a two-year-old yet. But nonetheless, Advertise is a very smart sprinter. And he'll be running in all the good sprint races between now and the end of the season, I would have thought.
And then, you know, not long thereafter, the upset in the coronation, where Watch Me at a hefty price for Graffard.
Again, this was a continuing a theme that had been set up the previous weekend with Francis Graffard, who Upwardly Mobile Trainer, doing really well in France, building up a good client base, trained some powerful owners, and he'd won the Prix de Diane, what for the French is the most important classic of the season, the French Oaks, and that was a wonderful performance from Channel on Sunday, and then he got his first Group 1 Royal Ascot winner with Watch Me, and that's a serious double in the space of 4 days. So full marks to him. He and his wife, Lisa Jane, she runs the French arm of the Godolphin operation. She's the racing manager of the Godolphin in France, Irish-born and educated in England, and then met her husband on the Godolphin Flying Start. They are a tremendous duo, both extremely talented, very bright, very able outfit, and I was absolutely thrilled for them to see them break through to this level.
Well, speaking of breaking through, each of the last few years during the broadcast, Nick, we're reminded that horse players and fans have been waiting for another female rider to win at Royal Ascot, and that happened. We were actually, Tina and I were getting in the car to head toward the wedding, and so I was not watching it live, and then I started to see the tweets and the celebration for Haley Turner. That obviously a special moment.
Yeah, and I'm pleased. I'm pleased it was Haley that did it. There are a lot of fantastic female riders plying their trade in the UK at the moment. Nicola Curry looks very assured, and she went pretty close to winning earlier in the week. Holly Doyle had gone very close to winning last year, and she's doing really well still. And there are plenty coming through that really look the part. But Haley has been at the top of her game for a long time. She was the first woman professional to ride 100 winners in a season. She was the first woman to ride a Group 1 winner, and then she followed it up by riding another Group 1 winner, and that was back in 2011. And she had the patronage of some really powerful Newmarket yards. She first jockeyed Michael Bell. She rode a lot for James Fanshawe. And then she had a couple of quite nasty falls, bit of an injury, got slightly jaded, possibly lost the confidence a little bit, retired for a while, did some media work, then found her enthusiasm for riding again, made a comeback, but very much on her own terms. She was going to go pick her way through rather than just relentlessly pedal the treadmill. And it seems to have worked well for her. And I think now with this victory under her belt, she can kick on and hopefully enjoy a really fruitful second career, if you like, as a jockey. She's very talented. She's got great patience. And it would be entirely appropriate that after that long wait, that she should be the one to make the breakthrough, and hopefully it will presage a whole load more successes for female riders. There's no reason why it shouldn't do, because trainers are more willing to give the opportunities now. And as I say, I'm just pleased it was Haley that did it, and I think she felt a greater depth of appreciation because it's not always been a walk in the park for her.
Well, and that makes it that much more special. I mentioned earlier what a great week it was for Danny Tudhope, and on closing day, booted home Space Traveler, which of course was one of the great hunch exactas between Space Traveler and Space Blues.
Yeah, he'll have been very pleased to win on Space Traveler because Steve Parkin, the owner of Clip Logistics, a wealthy guy, put a lot of money into the game. He has been a big supporter of Danny's for a long time now, so that will have given Danny a kick. Likewise, his victory on Lord Bitters for David O'Mara, without whom he wouldn't have ridden all those winners. It's been a huge couple of weeks for him. He's just ridden his 1,000th winner, and now he rides 4 at Royal Ascot, and he went damn close to riding 5 because Dream of Dreams went within a whisker of taking down Blue Point in the Diamond Jubilee. Another stride, and I think that result would have been different. So that was a very, very notable week for him. And most notably, I think, the people he was riding for. William Haggis, massive powerhouse Newmarket stable. He's ridden in 2 winners at Royal Ascot. That's going to cement his place as one of his go-to men now, if it hadn't already. And Sir Michael Stout, nearly riding a Group 1 winner for him, won't have done him any harm. And, with Ryan Moore's lack of availability to Sir Michael Stout in most of the feature races because of his commitments to Aidan O'Brien, it'll mean that he'll be looking to other jockeys. Like he used Frankie on Crystal Ocean, for example. He'll be looking to other jockeys to fill those mounts when he needs to. And Danny Tudhope just put himself in the frame maybe for a couple of group race victories for Sir Michael between now and the end of the season.
In another two other names that came into play on closing day, we already talked about Blue Point, but I thought Silvestre de Souza had a very good week, and then of course at Seni with the two on Saturday.
Well, de Souza's a super jockey, and he was probably a little bit unlucky on some of his rides earlier in the week. I think Fox Chairman is the horse that can go forward from a rather unlucky second to Sangarius in the Hampton Court. And it was nice to see D'Souza round off the week with a win for King Power. As I said, they ploughed a lot into the game. They had a lot of horses run well without winning. And then they got their winner, which was good to see. And as I say, Andrea Razzani, he's been a huge part of the ascent of Roger Varian. And two very assured performances on Defoe and Kate Byron. Defoe, who my good friend and colleague James Willoughby always used to rather cruelly refer to as the slow, until this year when he looked anything but slow. He was gelded in the winter, which seems to have made an enormous difference. And there was no fluke about his victory over Kew Gardens at Epsom in the Coronation Cup, and it was good to see him follow it up in the Hardwick. And he's going to be one of the most potent threats, I suppose, to Crystal Ocean when they meet the King George at the end of July. I don't see him quite being up to beating Crystal Ocean at a track which they both love, but he'd certainly be a worthy opponent.
Now, for you, Nick, in retrospect here, looking back, key moments and what will stay with you?
There's no doubt it was Dettori's Ascot. There was no doubt that he dominated in terms of news coverage and in terms of suffusing the place with an energy that no other human being is capable of doing in the sport of horse racing. So for that, we're eternally grateful. In terms of the horse of the week, well, the horse of the week is Blue Point, because he won two Group 1s in the space of 4 days, which is a remarkable achievement, whether it's at sprint distances or at staying trips. So he's the horse of the week. In terms of performance of the week, I'd say the performance of the week came from Crystal Ocean. I think that was a rock-solid, high-class Group 1 race. And he's a horse that thoroughly deserved at least a victory at that level, and it is going to not be the last victory at that level, provided he stays sound. And most exciting horse of the week, I think, was Pinatubo, who won the Chesham Stakes on Saturday. He ran a really, really fast time. It was a battle of the superpowers, two very exciting, well-bred colts from Godolphin and Coolmore. And I think Charlie Appleby has got another good horse, very good horse to look forward to. I think he's as good a two-year-old as we've seen out this season, and he'd be one to get excited about. The other two-year-old races I thought were just a touch disappointing, but it may well be that it was just a visual, slightly visually disappointing insofar as a lot of them were run when the conditions were at their worst. So we might want to reserve judgment. But there's no doubt that Pinatubo is one of the best two-year-olds we've seen so far, and he'd be a force to be reckoned with.
Well, how about from a personal standpoint? We saw lots of candids, and then, of course, after things wrapped, the crew and Brittany Erton, who has now become a fixture at these events, a couple of special quiet moments away from the camera's glare.
Well, we all had a good time. It's a huge operation, obviously, back in Stamford, but at Ascot, we are a tight and close-knit team, but they did a tremendous job, I hope. And I was pleased this year that we were able to generate even more of our own original content to supplement the excellent coverage that we were provided with of the races and the beautiful pictures that ITV are able to take. I'm hoping that the intermingling is working better with each passing year, and we're learning a bit more about how we can supplement each other's coverage to the sort of satisfaction really of an American audience. And it was a really healthy amount of people watched on Saturday morning, which is fantastic. And I couldn't have asked for better people to work with during the week, and Very grateful to Brittany for putting up with me for 5 days. But she's always great company and very talented. And our producer, Lindsay Shandra, led from the front and did a brilliant job.
Has Edzo opened up his own betting shop? Edzo Sport, maybe?
I'd like to think he was having a good time. I think he might have been slightly humbled by one or two of the results. Trying to get his head around those 30-runner straight mile handicaps was probably a bit of a challenge. But it was fantastic to see him looking, as I said on the broadcast last week, irritatingly smart and with an extremely nice top hat, which put mine to shame. Genuine silk number. It was fantastic to him to be a part of it. I hope he enjoyed it. And similarly, Dylan was back, having been with us last year as well. And she seemed keen that she'd keep coming back so long as we were covering the event, which is great.
Well, and I know you tried again to close out the stand with a winner at the end in the Queen Alexandra, and I was thinking what was in your head as Palisator was threatening a repeat.
What was really in my head? Well, there was a brief moment where I was thinking, damn it, I've deserted my old friend and he should never do that. Also done you a good turn. The worst feeling is when you just turned your back on him and he comes and bites you in the bum. But I was mainly thinking, is it really a good idea to try and close out this program in the thick of some very enthusiastic, well-lubricated racegoers in the middle of the bandstand from 3,500 miles away? But it was fine. It was all good.
Absolutely.
Nothing ventured, nothing gained. You've got to take a few risks in this life.
Well, it's a sure thing when we get to tune into you and whatever it is you're covering. And Nick appreciated the preview and always the recap. And then we're going to see you this summer, right? Soon enough.
Yes, I will be at Monmouth Park for the Haskell. And then I will see you toward the back end of the summer as well.
Perfect. Well, we'll be in Oceanport as well. We'll broadcast Thursday, Friday from the track. And because it's been moved to Saturday, the rare Saturday Haskell, we'll be able to stay. Because when it was on Sunday, we could never stay. Get to be around.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Nick Luck, everybody. Follow Nick. If you're not, I don't know why you wouldn't be. And Nick, just wonderful. Enjoyed it immensely. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Nick Luck, as good as it is, as good as it gets, and just unique. It's a unique race meet and fascinating. And I think every year more and more players get engaged. And even if you... It's one of those rare situations where if you don't cash a ticket, you don't feel terrible. You still enjoyed it. I only cashed one ticket. I was not happy, but took some shots. We'll get John White in here next and hit some of the highlights from a busy couple of days closing out Santa Anita and Neil Drysdale. I do want to get to Neil, if not today, then tomorrow. But Neil Drysdale with a pair of wins, finishing up strong. And how about Mark Glatt, who had just a spectacular meet? You know, we touched base at least twice with Mark, and he closed it out. Eddie Haskell, another win. Unbelievable. There were some maiden winners over the weekend, too, that you got to catch up on. So we'll talk to John, and we'll review closing weekend at Santa Anita when we come back at the races, back after this.
Racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
summer is one of the best times for serious horse players to bet their races. Saratoga and Del Mar are in full swing, along with other top tracks like Gulfstream and Laurel, and ExpressBet puts them all at your fingertips. Plus, ExpressBet customers can play in exclusive tournaments and promotions this summer, and new customers can earn a $500 sign-up bonus. Visit ExpressBet.com today. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void where prohibited. National Gambling Support Line, 800-522-4700.
With 35 years at the forefront of sports technology, Stats provides next-generation sports content for basketball, baseball, football, soccer. And now, Stats is turning its sights to horse racing. Racelens is the most in-depth product on the market. With innovative analytics powered by data from Echobase, it will change the way you follow horse racing. Stats Racelens, bringing clarity to handicapping. Learn more at stats.com/racelens.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back at the races, 25 into hour three. Thank Nick Luck for the full recap of the 5 days of Royal Ascot. Hope everybody enjoyed. On Wednesday, we'll get the final Royal Ascot conversation when Pete Fornatale, who might either be hungover or still drunk, potentially, from every picture you saw. It seemed of Pete. Somebody was pouring alcohol in his mouth. He had quite the adventure. He was either spilling alcohol on his morning jacket or looking for it. Apparently, did you follow the story of the missing morning jacket, morning coat? Yeah. It's pretty funny. We'll talk to Pete on Wednesday. John White joins us now, and John got to close out the long 6 months. Never has 6 months moved more slowly than these. And the scene shifts this week to Los Alamitos, mercifully. And John, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Talk about a tough act to follow.
Yeah.
Following Mr. Luck is very daunting, let's put it that way. He is just a marvel. And of course, we talked last week about Blue Point and what a big fan I am of Blue Point. And little did I know that he would pull off this royal double that he executed. He was the only horse I played in the entire Royal Ascot meet when he won that first time and paid $660 because I thought he should have been around even money. And so I was so tickled with that. And then when we got to the second one, I thought, well, do I play him again? Do I support him because I'm a fan? He's a much shorter price this time. You know, he is coming back in 4 days, and I thought, you know what, let's just root for him this time. And boy, when he came down to that finish, I was rooting for him, but I also in the back of my mind was, I'm really glad I didn't play him again today, even though he won. You know, I feel like even though I would have cashed, I made the right decision to pass the second time. I thought, you know, well enough is good. Let's just be happy that I had one bet during the whole Royal Ascot and cashed it at a pretty nice price. So, and then talking about Frankie Dettori brought back a couple of just special memories for me. The first Japan Cup I was ever at, 1991, that was won by Golden Pheasant and Gary Stevens. And Golden Pheasant, by the way, one of the favorite horses, if not maybe the favorite horse of Frank Miramonte, who will be returning to Monmouth Park to be calling the races there now that Santa Anita is over. And at that 1991 Japan Cup, I'll never forget being on a bus with a bunch of racing journalists, and Frankie Dettori was on the bus with us, and it was a long trip, so long that they were showing sumo wrestling on the TVs. You know, it was one of those buses with TVs, and they were showing sumo wrestling. And John McCrerick, who many of your listeners are familiar with, the I don't know almost how to describe him, racing scribe of England, and he was sitting with the Tory. They were betting on the sumo rest matches. So, and I mean, the Tory was just so animated about this, and he was so into the sumo wrestling that, I mean, I'll never, ever, it's the type of thing that today I'd have probably a good cell phone video of some of that, but that was way before, in 1991, long before cell phone videos. And then in 2006, I was at the international races in Hong Kong, and 3 days before the big four international races, they held a wonderful breakfast. It was a buffet breakfast in a section of Sha Tin, and you know, they had a whole slew of tables. I'd say there must have been as many as maybe 200 people at this breakfast, and Frankie Dettori was there. And I'll never forget how I was watching him, and it was like you'd be watching somebody running for president of the United States right now, like in New Hampshire or Iowa or something. He went through every single table in that whole huge room and just would introduce himself and say, you know, glad you're here, you know, I'm Frankie Dettori and so forth. And people were just so thrilled, and they'd say, well, can I have a picture with you? And this was right when cell phones were coming in, and so he would get up, and they'd take their picture with him. But I thought, what a great ambassador for racing. And that's going clear back to 2006. And then to see him, what he's doing, as articulated by Johnny D and you and Nick Luck and so many others, I mean, for him to do what he's doing at this age and so forth. And, you know, John Gosden, you talked about him. I got to know him so well when he was here in the early 1980s. And, I mean, one of the brightest, one of the most just wonderful and just an outstanding horseman in every respect. And it doesn't surprise me that Gosden would be shrewd enough to snap this guy up when he was available, because that's the type of thing Gosden had such a sharp eye to match the right rider with a horse. You know, Bates Motel, who was Gosden's real big star in the United States, along with Royal Heroine in the early 1980s, Bates Motel was like this over 17 hands mammoth son of Sir Ivor. And Gosden's, the job he did developing him into the stakes horse he became to win the Santa Anita Handicap, and it was a huge field that day. It was like something like 17 horses ran in that big cap. But the rider that John Gosden found to be a terrific fit with this horse, big mammoth horse, Bates Motel, was Terry Lipham. Now, Terry Lipham was a very successful quarter horse jockey. And let me tell you, you want to show the versatility of a jockey to win the All-American Futurity, which is the biggest race in quarter horse racing, which Terry Lipham did, at 440 yards, and be able to win the Santa Anita Handicap at a mile and a quarter, one of the prestigious thoroughbred races in the United States. We talk about this double for Blue Point. How, that's a pretty good double, winning the All-American Futurity and the Santa Anita Handicap as a jockey. So, but that was Gosden. He, you know, that was a sign right there of this guy and the marvelous things he could accomplish as a trainer. Look at what Gosden has gone on to do. So lots of big memories there. And then you were mentioning Monmouth Park, that you'll be there for the Haskell. I'm already looking forward to the Haskell. And one thing I like to do on your show from time to time is kind of give a warning of horses that I think are, might be live horses in a race at a price. And I believe, I'm looking ahead to that Haskell, and I think this Mucho Gusto could really have a big say in this Haskell. And you know, Maximum Security is going to be bet heavily again, and deservedly so, and is likely to be the horse to beat. And it'll be a good field. We know that. But I'm going to tell you what, this Mucho Gusto is really starting to kind of, the light switch to me is really going on. I think it's a case where he's kind of overachieved, really, up to this point. People have kind of pigeonholed him in terms of his talent. You know, it's like when I was kind of talking up Arrogate prior to when he kind of burst on the scene. You could really see that this Arrogate was maybe developing into a horse who could have a heck of a second half of the year. I did the same thing on your show with West Coast, and I put Mucho Gusto in that same category. Nice. I'm not saying he's going to do as well as Arrogate. I'm not saying he'll do as good as West Coast, but he might. From what I'm seeing so far, this last race was a thing of beauty for him. In which he rated so kindly, he raced wide. I never saw the track as for it, but he had to run so wide in that race. But he was so push button for Joe Talamo. And the fact, I love it when, you know, Bob Baffert is a guy, and we've talked about this, Steve, that he's a pretty easy read in a lot of respects. And, you know, Bob, often after a race, when he gets asked, well, what plans do you have for the horse? You know, a lot of the times he's reticent to say anything because he likes to kind of fly by the seat of his pants and see how the horses are training and so forth. And, I mean, he talked about this Haskell immediately for Mucho Gusto. And, boy, when you get Baffert to talk about a race immediately for a horse, that's often a huge, huge sign. And I don't have to remind anybody about Bob Baffert's record in the Haskell. So, and usually Baffert's horses are pounded into short prices in the Haskell. And I'm not saying Mucho Gusto is going to be some big long shot or anything, but I think he's going to offer some pretty good, decent value anyway. And I'm kind of excited of the prospect of Mucho Gusto maybe being able to pull off winning that Haskell.
Well, there's been you think about his I don't want to call them offbeat, but some of the Haskell winners that didn't necessarily distinguish themselves, you know, to a huge degree as the, you know, as the first half of the year was going, you know, going on, and maybe didn't he win with Coyle? Didn't Coyle win the Haskell?
I believe so. I believe so. Yes, 2011.
Yeah, that kind of, you know, it's that kind. A horse that, you know, some people were interested in at a certain point, you know, whether it was in their two-year-old year or later, and then, you know, kind of didn't fizzle out per se, but, you know, at the same time didn't really distinguish themselves in the first half of the year, but that's the kind of, as opposed to, let's say, like on Looking at Lucky, for
right.
instance, you know.
Well,
that,
I'll tell you another one that would fit kind of this profile would be Byron, because Byron was a horse, you know, that didn't run in the Triple Crown races, and so this is exactly the type of situation that I'm talking about, to where, you know, Byron had and ended up winning the Breeders' Cup Classic and used the Haskell on his way to doing that. So, you know, I mean, I really see this kind of possible upside for Mucho Gusto here. And part of the reason I've kept a close eye on Mucho Gusto is the sire. I'm a big fan of that Mucho Macho Man. And I thought that Kathy Riffo did just a marvelous job with him. And, you know, one reason I became a big Mucho Macho Man fan was the fact that I'll never forget when I saw he was a June foal. And for him to run third in the Kentucky Derby as a June foal, I just thought, wow, you know, that is really quite an achievement, actually. And it's no surprise to me, considering he was such a late foal, that he really didn't reach his peak until he was a 4- and 5-year-old, and he turned into one of the top older horses in the country. And Again, speaking of the Breeders' Cup Classic, he won a dramatic Breeders' Cup Classic at Santa Anita. So, you know, I really think that, and he ran well in the Breeders' Cup Classic the year before, again, but I Mucho Mancho Man was a horse, you know, and I talked about this in the past with you about certain pedigrees that in certain horses that get better as they age, and Dynaformers were that way. And Curlin is another one right now that whatever I see, when I see these Curlins doing well early, you know, I sometimes feel like we're only scratching the surface, because a lot of times the Curlins actually get better as they get older. And not always, but I mean, there are these generalities. And we've seen this all through, you know, racing history, that there are certain pedigrees at certain sires, and certainly Sid Fernando has touched on this himself on a number of occasions. So, but that's one reason why I'm looking at this Mucho Gusto. And part of the thing about handicapping and trying to make some money as a horse player, you don't want to be behind the curve. The trick is to be ahead of the curve. And the way you're ahead of the curve sometimes is to have these ideas of the breeding and so forth, to where you realize that there's still upside with a horse like a Mucho Gusto. And especially when there's going to be someone in there that's going to attract so much attention and so much money in Maximum Security. And one thing about Maximum Security, he proved that he's not infallible by getting beat in the Pegasus. And I honestly wasn't surprised he got beat in that race, because it didn't seem like he was going in there with all cylinders clicking. And that horse of Todd Pletcher's going clear back to last fall had been a horse that I'd heard through the grapevine that Pletcher was extremely high on, and that maybe thought was his best chance for the Kentucky Derby. And he ran in, and that was before he ran in the Kentucky Jockey Club, and he ran fourth there and then went on the shelf. So, you know, obviously something went amiss. But when he came back and won that Sir Barton King for a day, you know, that, and that's where speed figures, again, you want to be ahead of the curve, not behind the curve, because if you just went off speed figures, and this is why Maximum Security was 1 to 20, is because if you just look at the figures, the thoroughgraphs or the buyers, and but you pointed out last week, the thoroughgraphs gave him much more of a license to actually win the race than the buyers did, and that's one thing that's great about those thoroughgraphs. Again, they're such better numbers than the buyers to me. I've become such a proponent of these thoroughgraphs, I just can't recommend them more highly to people, that they're such a just great tool for you to try to help decipher these puzzles that are the handicapping puzzles. And but I mean, this is a case where I wasn't that all shocked that King for a Day was able to win that race. And as you pointed out, people were down on Maximum Security thinking, well, he ran some kind of a clunker. Well, not really. I mean, his buyer practically matched his Florida Derby and Kentucky Derby. So, I mean, it was a performance on a par with what he'd been doing. That, yeah. And it shows it wasn't that he ran a clunker as much as he faced a very good horse and an up-and-comer in the division as well, and King for a Day. And again, having that kind of inside info of how much Pletcher liked King for a Day, you know, made me take a more serious look at King for a Day than I'm sure a lot of people did. But the thing is, you're going to be at that Haskell, and like I say, I'm really looking forward to this Haskell, and especially with this Mucho Gusto. I just think that he's going to be a serious player in there for Baffert, and a serious player at, you know, we don't know the size of the field. We don't know who all is going to go in there. But there's a chance, you know, he could be a somewhat decent price in there. So that's where I say you can sometimes be a little bit ahead of the curve on these things.
Well, I know both of Greg Sacco's horses, Mind Control and Jovia, expected, along with King for a Day and Maximum Security. And then, you know, at the very least, the one from Baffert. And I wouldn't be surprised you know, we see a few other. You know, a few
I wonder
other
what they're.
Show
have
up.
You heard what they're going to do with Owendale?
We'll have, we'll know tomorrow because I've got Brad on tomorrow.
So good, good. Because
he was traveling this morning.
I mean, maybe that's too, I don't know if he'd want to come back that quick with him or something. Maybe he'll go more just point. But I don't know whether he wants to go to, onto the big, back with the big boys or, you know, a lot of money can be made with these races like he just won the Ohio Derby. So, I mean, I wouldn't blame him for either way he wants to go. I heard Andy Serling discussing this. You know, on the Naira show, and, you know, Andy has become a big Owendale fan. And I will tell you one thing. I have such respect for Andy. When he becomes a big fan of a horse, that's another thing that, that gets my attention, and I start taking a more serious look because Andy's track record is very good along these lines. And I, you know, here again, it's the Thoroughgraphs. If you go by the Thoroughgraphs, Owendale ran the best race in the Preakness. But, you know, he had the wide trip, and this is what's great about the Thoroughgraphs. They take so many more factors into account for their number than the buyers do. But, I mean, that's something that really grabs your attention, though, and you say, hey, that's interesting that, and I'm a huge War of Will fan, as you know, and he was my pick in the Preakness Wager Guide for Express Bet, and I played him and so forth, but I kind of feel like maybe I was lucky to win the race because, obviously, you know, War of Will had a perfect trip, saving all that ground on the rail, got through at the top of the lane, and Owendale, you know, I marked that down in my mind when I saw those Thoroughgraph numbers, thinking, boy, you better keep an eye. And I'll tell you another horse to keep an eye on. He just worked here, is Win, Win, Win. I still have not given up on him. And again, Steve Haskin has liked him all along. You've liked him all along. You know, and I that horse, I swear, one of these days is going to pop up and win a pretty nice race. And he's, you know, he's come up with some pretty good Thoroughgraphs in these races that are rather hidden. And that's why the Sheets players have done so well through the years. They find these nuggets, and they exploit these nuggets that aren't there so obvious for the public to see. And that's, it's, you know, easy to, when you see the buyers and some, like I say, maximum security off the buyers, that's why he was 1-20. But when you can get these nuggets of horses that actually ran better races than it appears, and the proof of how the Thoroughgraphs are better than the buyers, they make more sense because an example is the Preakness, where Owendale has the best figure for Thoroughgraph coming out of the race, but didn't win the race. The buyers, that never works that way. You know, they just go sequentially down in terms of how they finish the race. But we all know that the best horse doesn't win every race. So the Thoroughgraphs make a logical sense in terms of the fact that it intrigued me the first time I ever found that out. I thought, wow, isn't that interesting that you could finish fourth in a race but yet be perceived to actually have run the best performance? And for those of us who have ever bet a race, we know that that happens to where we feel like, man, my horse was the best in there, but because of these circumstances, he didn't win. And but that's where you can, again, exploit that down the line if you're on top of this and can find this out. So, but getting back to Andy Serling, you know, I mean, he was saying that he'd like to see Owendale in the Travers, and you know, I certainly at this point wouldn't discourage any thoughts along those lines. But again, you also, and Andy pointed this out, he said, look, I'd like to see him in the Travers, but I would understand if he took a more easy approach and went into some of these lucrative races that are a lot easier than the Travers. So I'll be fascinated to hear what Brad has to say, what their thinking is, because he's a nice horse. That's a, that Owendale, he's a, that Lexington, the race he ran that day, that move he made on that far turn, now he got my attention that day, I'll tell you that.
Well, 99, you got a 99, took a couple of days for the fig to come out from the Ohio Derby, but...
interesting. I've been waiting for that,
yeah,
so I'm glad you
came out this
that
morning.
One. That's a serious
99
number again. It fits right in with all the numbers that we've seen at the higher level of this class, because we haven't seen anyone in this group bust out with a, you know,
completely,
you know,
yeah,
big,
into
big
the
buyer. So,
well, second half of the year typically is when you're going to start
that's
to.
That's right. That's
you're
going
to watch for them. Let's, John. Let's get some of the Santa Anita stuff wrapped up. That because I'll probably get, I'll save Neil Drysdale's performances for a visit with Neil probably tomorrow. But the Wilshire obviously on Saturday with the. Simply Breathless and
it looked really good.
Nice win, 5-1. But I tell you, before that, even before we even got to the stakes on Saturday, how about Message? That was a nice performance. Baffert running 1-2 in the maiden race, the 6.5 furlong three-year-old filly group, and Message came back with a big fig. Actually, a 94 for her. In her second start, she's a Warrior's Reward from Bioma and an OBS April purchase, $300,000 last year, and took a while to get she come back from that September debut last year at Del Mar. And that was a pretty sharp comeback. And I imagine, you know, we haven't even talked yet about Mia Mischief beating Covfefe in the Roxalana at Churchill. We'll talk about Covfefe's miscue, not that she wasn't facing a good filly on Saturday, but you know, certainly off the race at Pimlico, I think more was expected. But anyway, this is a three-year-old sprinting filly for Mrs. Chu by Warrior's Reward out of a Carson City mare. So this one's not stretching out anytime soon. 94 buyer in her second start, and then came the rest of the action, and you know, that included the Snow Chief winner, our Silver Oak, that was for Jonathan Wong, coming down from Golden Gate. Mentioned Simply Breathless. And then on Sunday, John, some of the highlights included Mark Glatt, who had a spectacular winter and spring. I mean, for Glatt to almost win the training title, it's really a great accomplishment for him. And Eddie Haskell, who has wormed his way into a lot of people's hearts, followed up, really been a great winner for him. And he comes back and he wins the Siren Lure.
Well, just to briefly get back to that Snow Chief, that was a very challenging race to make the morning line because there were three possibilities for favoritism in that race: our Silver Oak, Irish Heat Wave, and Lieutenant Dan. And I made our Silver Oak 5-2, Irish Heat Wave 3, and Lieutenant Dan 3, because I'm telling you, it wouldn't have surprised me if any one of the three went favored. And I bet what pushed me into our Silver Luck was I paid particular attention to the distance of the Snow Chief and the fact that they were all stretching out to the mile and an eighth, and the way our Silver Oak at Golden Gate had closed so strongly, it indicated to me that, boy, that he was going to really like the 9 furlongs. And then you had Mike Smith, and that was you know, that's another one. When you get into these stakes, you better take that into account, and for good reason, because he wins so many of them. So, and he drew well. He was down on the inside. He was going to get save a lot of ground down there where Lieutenant Dan was marooned on the outside. But Irish Heat Wave ran too good to lose in this race. Honestly, it came down to a very close finish, but our Silver Oak did win it for Jonathan Wong. And did go off favored in the race at 2. So I felt kind of relieved that I had the right favorite in that race. And then Eddie Haskell, I mean, it was a wonderful week for me for turf sprinters because, as I've said, I'm right in there in the Blue Point fan club, but I'm also in the Eddie Haskell fan club, Mrs. Cleaver. And we've talked about it before, but one thing I wanted to mention about Eddie Haskell, and I talked about Andy Serling just a few moments ago, but just the other day you and Andy were talking, and Andy was talking what a big fan of Weya he was. Well, she's the third dam of Eddie Haskell. How about that? Weya nice. Is the third dam of Eddie Haskell, who has turned into this 5-furlong win machine for Mark Glatt.
Well, and of course, we're waiting later in the week. Breeders' Cup is going to meet, from what we understand, on Thursday. And I know that we've had that conversation with Mark after Eddie Haskell won the Daytona. He's in an unusual position, Glatt, when it comes to a couple of his sprinters. Eddie Haskell would prefer to, you know, that they keep this race at 5, potentially. And who's the other one that he's got, the other nice stake sprinter that would be better down the hill? So Glatt's kind of on the fence about which way it goes. But the Eddie Haskell story, to me, has been one of the the best ones of the meet. I got to also slip in, unfortunately, John, yesterday we were coming home and I really had not gotten a chance to look at all at Sunday's action in terms of PPs. You know, the draws were on Thursday and we were leaving, and so I didn't print out any PPs, and I completely missed the latest opportunity with a son or daughter of Hollywood Story and the last race of the meet. Here is John Sheriff's sending out Hollywood Girl for the first time, and I miss her, and she pays $32. I wanted to kill myself. I was so annoyed when I saw that she debuted, and what a missed opportunity this was.
Well, first of all, I'm glad you mentioned, I want to congratulate everyone on the wedding. So that
thank you.
That is such a huge, moment in life. And I can speak to that myself, having been married right across the street from Santa Anita in 1983 at a church called the Santa Anita Church. So there, how appropriate
Sweet.
Is that? But you mentioned Hollywood Girl, and look, the first person I thought of when I saw it, did the pedigree work on that race for the morning line, when I see that this Giant's Causeway is out of Hollywood Story, who do I think of? Steve Bick, obviously. I mean, this was like, I'm thinking, uh-oh, here we go. He's going to be on this one.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was trying to figure, this was an extremely hard race to make the morning line. We ended up with a plethora of 5-to-1 shots on the board. Nobody bet under 5-to-1. That's how wide open this race was.
Wow. Yeah, I see that.
That's the filly that I ended up making the original morning line favorite, Amara B, which kind of further complicated matters really in the race, and it was the final leg in the mandatory pick out of the Rainbow Pick Six. But I thought I was not going to go higher than 15 on her because of the fact of that strong family, and there was a debut winner that Hollywood Story has debuted. But it's not like John Sheriff's wins with, there was Nanastique and Zenyatta, but it's not a huge list of debut winners for John Sheriff's because he develops horses. You know, he lets them develop. And and the works looked pretty good for a sheriff's horse. So I didn't even want to go 15. I ended up making her 12. She went off at 15, as you pointed out, and paid $32. But I want to give some, a compliment to someone who has been on your show numerous times. That is Tom Quigley. I happened to catch his Rainbow Pick Six ticket that was posted on the simulcast show, and he singled Hollywood Girl on his Rainbow Pick Six ticket. Now, he didn't hit the first leg, so he got knocked out right away, but I don't care. That is one heck of a handicapping achievement in my book.
Whoa.
To put a ticket up on there and have a $32 winner singled in the last leg on a mandatory payout. So I just want to give, total praise there, because that's quite an accomplishment in my book.
Well, there's a couple of interesting factors here, and the fact that George Krikorian even sold this filly. I mean, typically he's sold the boys and kept the girls and campaigned them, and she fetched $875,000 as a Keeneland yearling going back to 17. And so that was number one. The works are solid. There's nothing particularly fast, and what would be, to me, the most difficult aspect of being that confident in her, the family. There's been a number of good babies that Hollywood Story has gotten, but they all take time to develop. And even though this one is, a 3-year-old debuting, in June of the 3-year-old year, I mean, it's not extraordinarily late, but, it's still a little bit in out there in terms of timing. And I that's a daring. We got to get to Quigley and see what, unless there was the big story about her. I mean, workout wise, there's one bullet back in April. So
because I judge Sheriff's works kind of on a curve, like Drysdale and Bill Spar and some others that, you're not going to see Baffert-like times anyway. So, I mean, even that last one, a 49-1, that first on this track, the way it's played
that's true.
Now.
That's true.
You know, that's a
good point.
For a sheriff's horse, that's like a, I'm not going to say a 46 and change, but that's like a 47-1 or something for Baffert. I mean, on the track that we had before. So, that's kind of something we had to make an adjustment for is, these times, the race times and the workout times. I'm going back to look at the pedigree work I did on the race. There were two debut winners that Hollywood Story has produced, Hollywood Star and Hooray for Hollywood. So that's where, like I say, that kind of caught my eye because, like you say, a lot of them did take time to develop, yet there were two debut winners that she produced.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Stormcat, that was her first. Hooray for Hollywood was her first one. She's got an honor code that's a two-year-old this year. See where that one is, Honor AP, and she skipped an 18, and she's got a Curlin weanling that be excited about. One of my favorite horses, Hollywood Story, and the horse that helped me even get an introduction to John Sheriffs, and she caught my eye when he ran her as a maiden in the Breeders' Cup, and she was fourth. Every one of her wins came at Hollywood Park, and they were. After running in a maiden race, she ran in nothing but stakes races the rest of her career. Go find one other horse that did that. John, thanks a lot. We'll talk in 2 weeks.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Have a great vacation.
Thank you. John White, everybody. Post time, John. Lots to do tomorrow, including I want to get to Uncle Neil Drysdale for his two wins. Phil D'Amato, too, because Phil had a pair of the stake wins coming out of the season. I want to thank Tom McGreevy for joining us to start the week and to talk about Jerry Hollendorfer. Jimmy Toner, Johnny D, the wonderful Nick Luck, and John, and Deja on the board. Replay 6 to 9 here on SiriusXM tomorrow. Visit the website later for archive and podcast. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you in the morning.